The whole philosophy of the way of life for which we are fighting means that consultation as equals should mark the activities, firstly, of those charged with the government of a democracy, and secondly, those jointly representing the several democracies. No single nation can afford to risk its future on the infallibility of one man, and no nation can afford to submerge its right of speaking for itself because of the assumed omniscience of another, end quote. Mr. Curtin said that we, who consistently sprang to assist others in resisting wanton aggression, were now called upon to resist an enemy who was powerful, useless, and well prepared. We accepted this challenge. All that we had was being mobilized into the organization to meet war with war, and to ensure the integrity of our country and the survival of Australian authority in Australia for Australians. Deputy Prime Minister Ford has released further information about fighting in the near north of Australia. Civilians have been withdrawn from Medang on the northeast of New Guinea. Communications with Bulolo have been restored. Civilians have been withdrawn from several parts of the Solomon Islands, and the Japanese killed over 5 Kieta. From Malaya, Australian Associated Press correspondent Ray Maley cables a vivid story of the exploits of the two Australian units who, in a desperate action against heavy odds, fought back after being surrounded by the enemy. The story, says Maley, will take its place in history with the famous charge of the Light Brigade in the Crimean War. He continues, quote, "The Australians suffered heavily, but for a week they held up a whole division of Japanese Imperial Guards, stopped enemy tanks, kept their wounded with them, and fought through enemy lines a distance of 15 miles to a position which they believed was in our hands. They got there exhausted without food and down to their last few rounds of ammunition, only to find that our previous position had been relinquished and that the enemy was blocking the bridge of escape. Even so, they had no thought of surrender. Day by day, their numbers diminished, but the survivors pressed on, and escaping through jungle swamps and now returning in twos and threes to headquarters," end quote. Ray Maley pieced his story together from the accounts of some of the survivors. Of the part the men played in the fighting generally, their GOC Major General Gordon Bennett says that they stopped the enemy from coming down the left flank armed with tanks at a vital time for the protection of troops in the center. He continues, quote, "The people of Australia have every reason to be proud of them and their fighting spirit and devotion to duty regardless of danger. They found themselves in a difficult and desperate position, but they refused to allow themselves to be dismayed. Their spirit was astounding. They were as full of fight at the last as they were at the beginning," end quote. We promise our allies as well as our enemies that the Commonwealth will be a nasty proposition for any aggressor. Whether we are left alone or have the help of others, we shall never give in. In these words, Army Minister Ford last night summed up Australia's determination to play her full part in the critical days that lie ahead. Mr. Ford said that Japan was trying, in the brief span of a few weeks or months, to crack open the established structure of this hemisphere by a greater concentration of force and willful ambition than accumulates in a century of life among peaceful people. Whatever the future held for us, Australia would try to face the test in a way which would leave it without regret. Mr. Ford said that the government's message to Australia was, quote, "Hold on, fight, work. Don't moan over losses. Yield nothing to the enemy without a fight. Stick like leeches. The tide will turn." End quote. Federal government is pushing ahead with the complete mobilization of civilian manpower. War Organization Minister Dedman said today that all males in Australia would probably have to register within the next 4 weeks. Registration would give a complete picture of labor forces within Australia. It would show what manpower resources were available, how they were made up, the number of skilled men in each group, and the industry they worked in. Mr. Dedman said that action to use fully the labor forces of the country would be taken gradually, there would be no economic waste and no sudden dislocation.
He said, quote,
certain materials will become scarce, and automatically the industry dependent on those materials will be restricted or prohibited because of the shortage. When that happens, we will take the men engaged in the industry and reabsorb them in positions where they're most required for the war effort, end quote. Bomb disposal squads of the latest ARP development in Australia.
Formation of these squads was announced today by
Army Minister Ford, who said that intensive preparations had been begun to provide the best possible disposal service at the earliest possible moment. It is understood that these preparations have been directed by an Australian Army officer who returned some time ago from England, where he had valuable training and experience in this intricate and dangerous work. The loss of the main points of the Northern Archipelago would foreshadow one of the greatest disasters to the white race in all history. This statement was made by Sir Keith Murdoch, head of a large Australian press chain, when he reached Darwin yesterday after an 11 weeks, 26,000 mile world flight. Describing these main points, Sir Keith Murdoch used a phrase new in Australian comment. He called them our points of re-entry. Japan's attacks on Burma and Rabaul, he said, showed clearly that she intended to have on each side of her prey a screen to prevent reinforcements getting through. Thus, she hoped to isolate Singapore and our points of re-entry. If Japan succeeded, the recapture of these points would entail withering losses, make the final contest with a sheltered and strengthened Japanese fleet difficult and indeed doubtful. Sir Keith Murdoch's trip to Britain and the United States was undertaken at the request of the British Minister for Information, Mr. Brendan Bracken. During his 11-week travelling, Sir Keith has interviewed political and service leaders in both countries and closely studied their war efforts. 80 refugee doctors who have asked for an opportunity to take up practice will be interviewed by a special committee this week. Health Minister Holloway said that if the doctors were approved for practice, they would be sent to country areas where medical services have been depleted by the military call-up. An amazing story of the expertness and diligence of three Aboriginal black trackers is told by men of a rescue party who found two soldiers who were lost in the bush near Darwin. Before the party set out, the trackers spent a full day studying the lay of the country and the likely direction which the lost men would take. They eventually picked up the tracks and followed them at speed over rocky reefs, where, according to mounted policemen, there seemed to be absolutely no signs to follow. The trackers led the party across streams and through dense bush, where only an occasional disturbed leaf or branch helped them. When they reached sandy country, the trackers told the police the height and build of the two men, deducing this from their strides and the impression of their boots in the sand. The missing men were found after a three-day search. And that is the end of the news from Australia. Which was written by Raymond Watt, discusses the real reason for Australia's insistence on the importance of the war in the Pacific. Messages from overseas seem to indicate that Australia's view regarding the war in the Pacific isn't fully appreciated in some quarters. Most of the messages deal with the safety of Australia and emphasize the very real sympathy felt by the people of Britain and the United States on this score. It seems to us, however, that this is not the crux of the argument. Naturally, we're deeply concerned about the risks facing the people of this continent. Nevertheless, it would be presumptuous of us to attempt to influence the grand strategy of the Allies merely on the ground that we might have to suffer hardships. If the storm should burst in its full fury upon us, then, like other countries, we can and will take it. That's the least we can do. But Australia's appeal for the utmost assistance is based on arguments that are realistic, not only from our point of view merely, but from the point of view of the Allies as a whole.
We endorse the opinion expressed today by a leading Australian just back from interviews with many of the world's leaders. He declared, quote, "The loss of the main points of the Northern Archipelago would foreshadow one of the greatest disasters to the white race in all history. That is why all possible help must be concentrated in the best strategic positions in these islands," end quote. That view is based on economic and strategic facts. Out of the storehouse of the Eastern Hemisphere comes much that's essential in the waging of war, as essential in the waging of war against Germany and Italy as against Japan. Already Japan has laid hands on the riches of Indochina and Thailand. The raw materials from both countries will help her to strengthen some of her weak links and thus prolong the war. But the resources of the Netherlands, East Indies and Burma, of Malaya and Australia are even more important. And she'll therefore doubtless try desperately to control them all. Japan knows that if she were blockaded, her difficulties would soon be desperate. Every step southwards is therefore an effort to prevent this blockade. But it's more than that. It's also an effort to turn this weapon of blockade against the Allies. Every extra ton of rubber she demands is a much needed ton of rubber less for the Allies. And the same applies to tin and oil, tungsten and quinine. If the war is to be a long one, all these commodities will be fully needed by the Allies. They therefore cannot afford to have such riches pass into the hands of the enemy. Most people know in a hazy sort of way that the Eastern Hemisphere is very rich in the raw materials mentioned. Not so many realize that every country depends on this part of the world for practically all of its rubber and quinine, and for most of its tin and tungsten. British Malaya, Borneo and Sarawak produce 44.6% of the world's rubber, and 33.3% comes from the Indies. As 6.6% comes from Indochina and 4.6% from Thailand, it'll be seen that almost the whole of the world's production of rubber is concentrated in countries either overrun by Japan or critically managed by her. British Malaya also produces 26.7% of the world's tin. The East Indies, 16.9%. Between them, these two countries thus produce nearly half the world's tin. With Thailand, China, and Indochina, they account for nearly two-thirds of the world's total of tin. Tungsten, which is essential for making high-quality steel, also comes mostly from this part of the world. China and Burma together produce 54.2%. Two other metals much needed by Japan can also be found in New Caledonia, chrome ore and nickel ore. This free French outpost in the Pacific turns out each year about 26,000 metric tons of chrome ore and 7,000 tons of nickel ore. The possession of these islands would certainly help Japan a lot. Japan's struggle in the Pacific is also a struggle for petroleum, especially for the 8 million tons a year produced in the Netherlands East Indies. Most experts seem to agree that Japan's reserves of oil cannot be large, and that their power to continue after a year or so may depend mainly on getting the oil at the Indies. Fortunately, the Dutch are fully alive to this fact and are scorching the earth ruthlessly. They're cementing the wells and dynamiting the installations at terrific cost to themselves. Nevertheless, the Japanese will probably have the wells flowing within 6 months, unless they're stopped. Actually, only 2.75% of the world's oil is produced in the Indies, but those 8 million tons are badly needed by the Allies in this part of the world. If Japan controls that output, we'll be weaker, but Japan will be immensely stronger. That applies to all the items mentioned, rubber and tin, tungsten and quinine, as well as oil. The Allies cannot afford to lose them. And Japan will be immensely stronger if she gains them. She might indeed be so strong that she could prolong the war for a long, long time. And that would have most serious repercussions on the fighting in the Atlantic and in Europe. Every defeat in the Pacific is also a defeat in the Atlantic and in Europe. We in this country cannot see these things separately. To us, they're all part of the same struggle against the Axis powers. We gave evidence of this belief when we sent our armies and our equipment to Libya and Greece, Crete, Syria, Malaya. Every one of those campaigns proved Australia's conviction that this war is one and indivisible. And that a challenge to one part is an equal challenge to all the other parts. The very fact that Japan is taking heavy risks and swinging all her weight confirms the fact that she considers the prize supremely important. That if she can control the raw materials of the Eastern Hemisphere, victory may well be within her grasp. That is why she wants to isolate Singapore and prevent our re-entry into the islands. That is why she has flung out a screen right round from the Solomon Islands to Burma. She knows that if she can entrench herself in this greater East Asia area, the Allies would almost certainly have to face withering losses to get control again. She knows more. She knows that if she can control the Australian continent, then her Allies will have lost their most important operational base in this part of the world. And it'll be much harder for them to carry on their war against Germany. It's for reasons such as these that our leaders have asked our friends to help all they can, as quickly as possible.
Intense air activity is reported in Malaya. British forces have maintained their positions despite strong Japanese pressure, supported by incessant attacks by bombers and fighting planes. In the east of the peninsula, at Mersing, Japanese land activity has been limited to patrol operations which have had to face violent artillery fire. On the central front, British forces attacked the enemy north of Kluang. In the sector of Beitou Pahat, fighting continues. Australian and Indian forces that had been cut off from their bases in the sector of Paris Yulong and were supplied by air have now succeeded in rejoining the main body of the British forces after fierce fighting. On the 25th, says a Japanese communique, the Japanese army in Malaya advanced southwards through central Malaya against British forces at only 2 kilometres southwest of Kluang, a strategic railway junction 60 miles north of Singapore. The capture of the town is considered imminent. The airfield is reported to be ablaze. Units of Japanese forces pressing the remaining 20,000 British forces to the middle sector of Johor dealt those forces a severe blow between Kluang and Ayer Haitam, while another Japanese unit advancing from the west coast reached Sengarag, 10 miles southeast of Beitou Pahat, and cut off the enemy's retreat from behind. According to this evening's Japanese communique, Japanese troops have already occupied nearly half of the province of Johor by annihilating nearly all the British troops amounting to 20,000 men. They have reached a line stretching from east to west from Kluang to Ayer Haitam, a distance of 32 miles. Violent fighting is going on in a semicircle 40 miles from Singapore. Moreover, Japanese forces operating on the west coast have arrived at Sengarang, 10 miles southeast of Beitou Pahat, and have cut off the enemy's retreat. The official British communique confirms the occupation by the Japanese of Beitou Pahat and announced that there were 2 raids on Singapore yesterday. The communique from the Dutch East Indies reports that Japanese troops have landed at Tendari and at Balikpapan in Dutch Borneo, despite the stubborn resistance of the Dutch forces. No details have been received so far concerning the development of operations. Japanese air forces had been particularly active towards the end of the past week in various regions of the Dutch Indian outer possessions. Amboina, for instance, and the neighborhood was bombed and machine gunned, as well as the sectors east of the Dutch Indian archipelago. Sorong, Melia, Manakuri, and Belamang had all been attacked. According to a Japanese communique, Japanese reserves have concluded their landing operations on the coast of Batanga in the Philippines. They have already occupied nearly all the enemy positions and are driving the Anglo-Filipino troops towards the cul-de-sac. The Shanghai Municipal Council decided 2 days ago to adopt Japanese standard time after the 1st of February in the whole town. For the time being, Shanghai Standard Time is 1 hour behind Tokyo time. In Melbourne, the War Cabinet and the War Council met yesterday. It is expected that Mr. Curtin will call a meeting of experts sooner than was anticipated. The War Cabinet is believed to consider that the Japanese landing in the Solomon Islands is of no great military importance, but Australia is nevertheless anxiously awaiting London's reply to her proposals, tending to modify the Allied plans with a view to facing Japanese strategy. The Australian communique says that Japanese Marines have landed at Kavieng in New Ireland. The evacuation of Lac at New Guinea has been concluded. The town was violently bombed on the 22nd of January. Few details have been received with regard to the fighting in New Guinea, but Australian troops are resisting magnificently. The British wireless is reported to have announced that a Chinese military mission will leave Chongqing shortly for London. And so we come to the news concerning operations in Europe. The British Naval Ministry gives the following details with regard to the torpedoing of a 20,000-ton liner by British forces in the Mediterranean. The convoy was one of the most important to be found in the Mediterranean and was composed of a large liner of several merchant ships, a battleship of cruisers and destroyers. It was sighted on Friday morning by reconnaissance planes. The liner was at the end of the convoy, and the pilots did not miss it. Meanwhile, another British torpedo scored a direct hit on a destroyer, which exploded. Shortly before midnight, Wellington bombers had also localized the convoy, and they in turn proceeded to attack it for an hour and a half. Bombs were dropped around the liner, direct hits were scored on a cruiser and on two merchant ships. The convoy was completely dispersed. When the bombers finally left the neighborhood, the whole of the convoy had disappeared. On Saturday morning, it was sighted again by reconnaissance planes, but no trace was left of the liner. The British wireless announces that Mr. Churchill crossed the Atlantic on the Duke of York. This is the first news indicating that the Duke of York has been put in service. It is a 45,000-ton battleship of the same class as the King George V. Fighting in North Africa seems to be as fierce as ever in the Jedabia sector. From German sources, it is reported that Axis motorized and armored units have encircled and destroyed British armored formations. Several of the tanks were captured in good condition and were immediately made use of. The British communique states that it is now known that during the fighting that took place on the 23rd of January, five German tanks were destroyed. On the 24th, extremely confused fighting took place in an immense sector south and southeast of Antelat and southwest of Sonu. A formation of German tanks was attacked yesterday by British infantry, supported by artillery forces, and was dispersed. Moreover, British forces successfully attacked German means of transport on the road from Jedabia to Antelat, and several vehicles were destroyed. The Minister of State in the Middle East, Sir Oliver Littleton, is making a visit to Iraq and Persia. According to an official announcement published in Cairo, the Minister of State has left to visit Iraq and Persia. It will be recollected that these two countries were recently added to the Middle East military command. With regard to operations on the Russo-German front, it is reported that fighting continues in spite of the severe cold. Russian attacks, says the German communique, have been repulsed southeast of Kharkov, and several tanks have been destroyed. German and Finnish planes have inflicted heavy losses of men and material on the enemy on the Karelian front. Another German communique adds that Soviet forces attempted to carry out landing operations on the south coast of the Crimea during the night of the 23rd, but the attempt failed. According to information from French source, the situation up till yesterday was as follows. On the northern and central fronts, the Russians continue to develop their offensives in the direction of the important railway junction of Velice Luki. Secondly, on the southern front, the situation has been stationary for the past 2 days. Violent attacks southeast of Kursk and in the Donetsk basin have been repulsed. The situation in the sector of Kharkov is as calm as can be, and the German forces have taken advantage of this lull to reinforce their positions north and south of the Tatten. Russian troops operating in the Kerch Peninsula continue to withdraw from Vladislavovka, and in the Crimea, the Russians succeeded in landing 1,200 men, but most of them were taken prisoner before having had the time to enter into action. In the west of the peninsula, the situation remains unchanged. Fresh Russian attacks on the Sevastopol front have been repulsed. A period of restrictions has begun in Turkey, who, up till now, have miraculously escaped rational measures. After the rationing of bread and the sudden increase in the price of sugar, informed circles now announce restrictive measures for the consumption of fat, oil, butter, and soap that Turkey produces in abundance.
News bulletin now for the benefit of radio listeners who might want to take down some items that may be of special interest to you. Here's the news from Chongqing. Today's Chinese war communique, as released by the official news agency here, reports that Chinese forces counterattacking in the Weiyang area on the South Guangdong front have recaptured Foklo, Foklo, strategic highway town on the north bank of the East River. The Chinese re-entered Foklo on Friday afternoon, following the rout of the Japanese, who have since been fleeing back towards Foklo, their advance base about 45 miles east of Canton. Foklo is spelled S-H-E-K-L-U-N-G. The enemy sustained very heavy losses on Thursday when the Chinese made a furious counterattack on Foklo's northern and western outskirts from Dong Chau Tak. He was finally driven out of the town by midnight on Friday. Occupation. An enemy attempt to dislodge the Chinese from their position north of Shenzhen, S-H-U-N, on the Canton Kowloon Railway was repelled following a brief period of spirited fighting. In central China, several local attacks by the enemy in the vicinity of Nanchang, N-A-N-C-H-A-N-G, former Jiangxi capital, Jiangxi, more than 800 officers and men from the enemy's puppet police force in Nanchang have deserted the enemy camp during the past week, joining the ranks of a nearby the Yangtze River. Only a attack on Chinese position to the northeast of Yangtze, I-C-H-A-N-G, on the west super front. Today spelled H-U-T-E-H. Many casualties were inflicted on the enemy. On the North Hunan front, Hunan is spelled H-O-N-A-N, the Chinese recaptured three points S-I-L-U-A-N on January 23rd. Over 100 casualties during the encounter. You are listening to the news broadcast from Chongqing. Recent statements by Colonel Frank Knox, U.S. Navy Secretary, are continuing to receive favorable comments in this country. His special message to the Chinese people, according to a survey made by the official news agency here last night. It's regarded by official and non-official observers in the Chinese capital as having cleared away the last shred of misunderstanding that may have been invoked by hasty reading of his speech on January the 12th. That there are many worlds at land and at sea, but only one world, home by with the Chinese rule of the present conquered, which is pointed out. The U.S. Navy Secretary, recognition of recent Chinese victories, is reciprocated by the enthusiasm with which the Chinese people have hailed the victories of the Mestcastle Straits. The Chinese people recognize keenly the bond Colonel Knox mentioned that exists between the people of the United States and the people of China at this moment, and are deeply concerned that this bond shall not slacken, it is further stated. Commenting on Hitler's Berlin speech, the Dagobah remarked, the self-appointed German commander-in-chief virtually admitted defeat for the Reichsmarine, which, in the course of his lengthy speech, he praised General Rommel without mentioning the hard-pressed German armed forces in Russia. It was hardly fitting that the author of Blitzkrieg honored the wounded and disabled by feeding them next to himself, urging the German people to speed up production instead of ordering a general counteroffensive against the Soviet army. This famous European tenor failed to impress his admiring audience. This time, the influential Chongqing paper pointed out jokingly, adding that perhaps this was because his voice had been lost somewhat due to an unfortunate cold caught during his overconfident march against the Russian Admiral Frost. Turning to the recent statements made by President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, the Dagobah declared that one can find in the heart of great men unbreakable determination to win a war, though an invincible army, is never to be found. Let me read this sentence over again. Turning to the recent statement made by President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, the Dagobah declared that one can find in the hearts of great men unbreakable determination to win a war, though an invincible army is never to be found. China, on the part of her national leader and the people at large, has always had such determination, and that is why she has been able to fight the enemy for 5 years with increasing vigor and confidence, the paper said, adding that as surely the United Nations have such common determination, plus a comprehensive program of victory, which is now in full operation. Any temporary successes the enemy may have scored, or may yet be able to score for a while more, do not matter much in the long run. The prosecution of this war cannot be expected to change the rules as embodied in these groups of mentions. Our cooperation is more important than geographical superiority, the Dalai asserted. The Catholic daily, Social Welfare, declaring that all Chinese people are eagerly awaiting the news of Chinese expeditionary forces in Burma, dealing their heaviest punches on the enemy in the Indochina Peninsula. Realizing, as we all do, the grave situation of the Singapore fortress, we cannot afford to miss the present opportunity for concentrating our veteran fighters for striking at the enemy's rear from Burma before Japan is able to move more troops against them later in case Singapore falls. Moreover, the position of the premier naval base would be greatly relieved if a crushing blow is delivered to the enemy from Burma now, the Catholic Daily added. Meanwhile, the Chinese army organ, Shaodongbao, declared that China and Britain, for reasons historical and economic, as well as geographical, must see to it that they line up all their combined forces on the spot to hold Burma by all means and at all costs. We cherish the highest pride in the spot of which our men there are made. With the experience morale that they truly have, the Shaodongbao believed, they would be able to give a good account of themselves and thus live up to the expectations of China's allies. Continuing the news from Chongqing. Latest information from the South China front reveals that the Chinese counterattacking the enemy on both banks of the East River are continuing their relentless pursuit of the retreating enemy. Pukuo was recaptured at 6 o'clock on Friday evening. Many casualties were inflicted on the enemy, while over 30 prisoners were taken. The Chinese also captured large quantities of war British, including two light artillery pieces and numerous rifles, as well as machine guns.